Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vint, sitting in for Mindy Todd. According to the USDA, 3/4 of the world's flowering plants and about 35% of the world's food crops depend on pollinators to reproduce. While there aren't exact figures, surveys in the U.S. and Europe are documenting pollinator population declines and even local extinctions of certain species. Not only can pollinator decline have an impact on world food production, pollinator health is an indicator of the ecosystem's overall health. We're talking pollinators this hour and how we can protect them both globally and locally. Joining us on the phone from Portland, Oregon is Mace Vaughn. He's the co-director of the Pollinator Conservation and Agricultural Biodiversity Program at the ZSERS Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Mace, good morning. I think I just butchered the name of your society.
You might have. It's the ZSERS Society, but it's great to be on, Amy.
Thank you. Also with us is Larry Dapsis. He's an entomologist and tick project coordinator at the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here again.
Also with us is Marty Ayers from the Barnstable County Beekeepers Association. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
And thank you so much for extending the invitation for us to come and to be here today.
Before we get into the weeds with pollinators, Mace, can you give us an overview of the mission and the work of the ZSERS Society?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So we are a conservation nonprofit. We were founded about 45 years ago. And our mission and our work is to help people protect habitats and create landscapes that can really support a wide variety of insects and other invertebrates that are fundamentally important for pollination, for helping to control pests, for feeding wildlife, for really just creating healthy ecosystems all across the country.
You work with many different stakeholders, and we'll get to some of those later in the program. But I'm curious because you've worked with the USDA, the government agency. Has that partnership shifted since the Trump administration took over?
That's a really interesting question. And for my work directly on the ground with my staff, it hasn't dramatically changed in that most of the people that I manage, and I've got a team of maybe 15 conservationists, 15 specialists across the country who work mostly with farmers, hand in hand with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. And if anything, I've seen opportunities for their work to just increase over the last, over the last 2 years. We bring a very special skill in terms of thinking about how do you protect pollinators and other beneficial insects, a skill that's quite unique. And the farm community has really been worried about this. The beekeeping community has been worried about habitat for pollinators. And those folks have, they just see more work every day. In fact, I'm trying to figure out how to get more people on the ground in New England to be able to help the NRCS really expand that mission, expand that work for pollinators across your region.
That's good news. When we say pollinators, the first thing that pops into most people's minds are probably bees, but there are a number of insect species that are pollinators. That even includes birds and mammals. Larry, can you give us a sense of the different animals and species that are included under that term pollinator?
Sure. There's a number of players in this. In the insect world, there are moths that pollinate. There are types of flies, beetles, ants to a certain extent. So it's not just bees, but bees are a big, big player in the world of pollination ecology.
And the birds?
Yes, the hummingbirds, and notable.
And you were saying off the air that people might be surprised at the number of different bee species that we have in this region.
Sure. People, they really open their eyes when I tell them that on Cape Cod, we have 100 species of bees. So it's not just honeybees and bumblebees. There's a lot of players that go virtually unnoticed.
And pollinators are considered that keystone species. Mace, can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so fundamentally what that means is without pollinators, we do not have this service of pollination. So as you suggested when we started the show, more than 75% of plants need an insect pollinator to move pollen from one flower to the next in order for that plant to set seed, to be able to create fruit. Those seeds and fruits then lead to the reproduction of those plants, but they also lead to food for wildlife. such that if you took pollinators out of the equation, you would have all sorts of different interactions. The whole ecosystem has the potential to fall apart, as if you pull the keystone out of an archway and the bridge in the archway collapsed.
And Marty, pollination is that co-evolutionary process. So what are the benefits to the pollinators?
Well, first of all, they need it to survive. So they eat the pollen and they bring in the nectar also. And it's part of excuse me, of their diet.
And then you're a beekeeper. And then can you explain the process of the role of pollen in the honey-making process? Or is it just food for them to then create?
It's food for them, but we can trap the pollen with special traps. That's the propolis. The pollen is strictly used for the bees for their diet.
For their diet.
Right.
Okay. What are some of the examples of foods that wouldn't be possible without pollinators?
Nuts, almonds. It's a big industry in California.
Your Cape Cod cranberry industry would disappear.
Exactly.
There's a lot of importers that come in with the bees to pollinate. Mm-hmm. Blueberries, they move from Florida they move from the south. I'll include the West Coast on this. They move from the south up to the north by what is in bloom at that time. And so they'll start off in California with the almonds, eventually ending up in Washington State with the apples. And on the East Coast, it's down south with the fruits that are down there, moving up to, I think, Maine's blueberries come in first before the cranberries
they
on
do.
Cape Cod. So they go to Maine first, and then they come back to Cape Cod.
And this is a big business. I mean, we're not imagining that the bees figure or the pollinators figure this out. There are companies that move these pollinators around. Is that right?
Sure. There's 1 million acres of almonds in California, and over two-thirds of the beehives in the country are moved into that crop during the month of February. And as Marty indicated, these girls work hard. They're moved to a lot of different places. And that's very taxing on them health-wise. So, you know, there's nutrition stress and so the stress of travel and having a restricted diet. So when you go into a monoculture like almonds, that's not nearly as beneficial as having a diverse set of forage.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Maybe you can weigh in here. Since we, you know, farmers are specializing, maybe growing one or two kinds of crops, how does this impact the pollinators?
I mean, you just hit on the heart of it. It has a significant impact. As Larry was just suggesting, if you bring your bees into a 4,000-acre almond ranch or into 200 acres of blueberries, that's a lot of food at one time, but without a lot of variety. And we know that bees, honeybees in particular, but bumblebees also, really thrive when there's a variety of different pollens that are coming into the hive, when there's nectar coming in over time. Those variety of pollens provide a whole mix of nutrients compared to just a single type of pollen from a single flower. And in the past, you know, so much of our agricultural landscapes would have had more diversity. And so this really gets at the heart of our work with the farm community. On the one hand, sure, I would love to see farms going back to having a real mix, a real variety of different crops being grown that could in and of itself help provide that variety of pollen and nectar through time. But when that's not possible, can we bring in things like hedgerows? Can we bring in flowering borders? Can we have cover crops growing around those farms? Can we take forest edges that have become overgrown and push them back a little bit or thin them out to let more of that understory come up so that in the area around cranberry bogs or blueberry barrens or almond orchards, we could have just more variety of plants in the landscape that are better able to support our bees and butterflies and other pollinators.
It seems like humans have really inserted themselves into this process. Do we have a sense of how many natural pollinators, and I mean natural that are not being trucked from, you know, field to field, versus the sort of ones that we move around are part of this pollination process for food crops?
We do, actually. Increasingly, we've got more and more information. There are scientists like Ann Averill at the University of Massachusetts and her colleagues who've been looking, let's say, just at cranberry and berry crops in New England and see dozens of different bee species. Larry mentioned there are over 100 bee species alone on Cape Cod. There are 3,600 across the U.S., and there's a lot of evidence showing that our different cropping systems have dozens of different bees that have the potential to be visiting them and providing really meaningful pollination. And so if we can do things like create habitat around these farms, we can be supporting those bees outside of the crop bloom, so they're there to help with crops or there to help with your backyard garden. And at the same time, be helping beekeepers by having more forage in the landscape for their honeybees as well.
Humans are always looking for technology for a fix. And I'm wondering if, do you know of any research into alternatives to insect and bird pollinators? I mean, maybe this is really out there. Maybe it's not even necessary. But could there be, for example, a really tiny drone that you could program to start pollinating?
I mean, people are looking at it. There every so often a study comes out about these little micro drones going out. But I'll tell you, when it comes to replacing the pollinators themselves, the short answer is no. Nature's got it dialed in. Nature figured this out. You know, evolution has created this wonderful relationship between a flower and an insect. And, you know, the best thing we can do is think about how to better support those insects in and around our farms and gardens and natural areas.
Yeah, that all gets to the fact that bees and plants have co-evolved over time. So that's a partnership that goes back millions and millions of years. So we can't reinvent that in any way that's going to be better.
And when you look at individual species, you can see how they've adapted to get the pollen out of particular plant species,
sure.
Right?
There are some pollinators that are specific for certain plants. If you look at cranberries as an example, bumblebees and cranberries co-evolved, and they are far more efficient than something like a honeybee at getting pollen out of that blossom. They actually have evolved to what they call buzz pollinate or sonicate, so they vibrate their wing muscles, and that pollen just falls out of the blossom, whereas a honeybee, they are almost pollinated by accident.
And how do we track and monitor pollinators? I mean, given the size and the distribution of the species, it seems like it would be really challenging to do that.
It is. I mean, surveillance work is tedious, takes a lot of labor. Fortunately, when we have scientists like Ann Averill, she's been doing surveillance of bumblebees in southeastern Massachusetts. She has 30 years of data looking at trends in population levels, but also the species composition. And we've seen, you know, a dramatic shift over the years, particularly in bumblebees.
And Mace, are there certain other species of pollinators that are declining at a faster rate? And what are those?
Well, it's interesting. We know, for example, that honeybee beekeepers are still losing up to 40% of their hives every year. But when we look at our native species, as Larry suggested, our bumblebee species, our different bumblebee species have been declining significantly. So the whole community in New England has shifted, as he's suggesting. But we've got efforts across the country through a program called Bumblebee Watch, where volunteers can go out and, using an app on their phone, learn how to identify their local bumblebees or take pictures of bumblebees. And through that, we've been able to help both document the decline in species like the rusty patch bumblebee or the yellow-banded bumblebee, and also help understand where those species that we've seen dramatic declines in currently exist. I will say almost 30% of our bumblebee species are really in dramatic decline, a couple of which, well, the rusty patch bumblebee is now a listed species in the U.S. on the Endangered Species Act, and several others we're seeing dropping out. And from within our bee community, bumblebees are probably the group that we know the most about, and we're trying to, over time, learn more about all those other thousands of other native bee species.
We are talking pollinators this hour. If you have questions or comments, or maybe you've had success with particular plants that attract pollinators, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and we're talking pollinators this hour. Joining us on the phone from his home in Portland, Oregon, is Mace Vaughn. He's the co-director of the Pollinator Conservation and Agricultural Biodiversity Program at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And in studio, Larry Dapsis, entomologist and tick project coordinator at the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension. Also with us is Marty Ayers from the Barnstable County Beekeepers Association. Marty, what are the local beekeepers seeing? Has it been challenging to keep your bees? Have you been seeing disease? Have you been seeing a lot of winter die-off? Or what's your experience been?
The winter die-offs are always a problem for us, even with using soft, as we call them, organic medications in the hive in the wintertime or in the fall time. But on average, it's the same throughout all of Massachusetts, about 40%.
And is that typical if you look back over, you know, decades of,
I've only been here for 18 years, but the progress has continued, I think, to climb. Years ago, we had the trachoma mites that were a problem, and now we're into the varroa mites, which are more of a problem. And then again, it's the habitat that's in decline with more housing and less urban fields for the bees. And we try to stay away from all the pesticides and the insecticide dilemma that's going on around the area. But we just had 300 hives packages delivered yesterday on Cape Cod. It's the highest we've ever had that we've imported in, just to make up for the loss. And we have extra. We have up to 350 or more members in our club now. So a lot of the packages all went to just the people in our club. So it's not to say all of the other beekeepers that are not in our club that are on Cape Cod and what they're doing, we have no knowledge of because they're not in with us. So,
right. Well, we've mentioned two things about decline. One is disease and one is habitat loss. Do we know, are they equal in terms of how they're impacting pollinators, or is disease more of a problem? What are you finding, Larry?
If you look at the reporting of the state bee inspectors, when people lose hives, they go out and they'll investigate why. And last year, about a third of the losses were due just to varroa mite. There's certain percentages lost to different disease like foul brood or chalk brood or deformed wing virus. Several percent might be due to pesticides and problem, you know, maybe a drift problem from, you know, treating an area and drifting into where bees are foraging. So the state inspectors, yeah, they year on year are looking at, you know, okay, what are the causal agents? But varroa mite is a huge player in this.
Always the question of climate change comes in when we're talking about any sort of species. Do we know if a warming climate, I mean, could that be creating a better environment for disease, or is there any connection that anyone knows of?
That's hard to put a finger on because we don't have long-term surveillance. So we don't have baseline data to establish, okay, what has changed weather pattern-wise in the last 30, 40, 50 years. And does that explain what we're seeing in different populations? So I think people tend to look at, you know, for a smoking gun per se. So climate change is that the smoking gun? It's from my standpoint, there's probably six smoking guns that are impacting pollinator health and density and things like that.
I would generally agree with that. I feel like with climate change, we are seeing, for example, a shift in where bumblebee species occur across the country that seems to be related to climate change. And we do know that monarch butterflies or bumblebees or honeybees end up suffering when we've got more extreme periods of drought, for example, in the Central Plains states or even in the Southeast. Or they're also impacted when we have much wetter seasons. And so as we have more of that dramatic climate variability, both wet and dry can have impacts on our pollinators.
And I was another question I had was about bloom times for different species of plants. I imagine that's being impacted by climate change. But are pollinators pretty easy? Are they able to adapt to that shift in when things come into bloom?
Yeah,
depends
usually
a little bit on the species. So if you've got bumblebees, for example, you know, the life cycle of a bumblebee colony is such that the queen comes out of hibernation in the early spring overall, and then builds a small colony through the summer and then wraps up at the end of the summer in the fall. And so long as there is bloom, abundant bloom throughout that whole season, they're okay. And so if the bloom time of different species shifts, they're probably all right. But other bee species, some butterfly species, are really tuned into a smaller number of plants. We have a whole suite of bees that are going to be coming out soon if they aren't already in your backyards, you know, ground nesting, mining bees, mason bees, that are really much more tuned to, say, those spring emerging flowers. And if those spring flowers come out too early before the bees do, you know, you could potentially have those sorts of disconnects where the abundance of the flowers they're looking for might not be there might not be as abundant when they're ready to be foraging on them.
Ticks in our region are a problem because they're vectors for many different diseases, serious diseases, and there are a number of services that will treat your property to reduce ticks. What are the common pesticides these services use, and do we know if they could be harmful to pollinators? Larry, we'll start with you.
Sure, it's a fair question. One of the things I've been advocating for my 8 years here is that as a 1-2 punch, permethrin treated clothing and footwear primarily for personal protection, but perimeter yard sprays. And so the products I recommend for the yard sprays are, if you're going to do it yourself, you know, go to a garden center, you can get a hose end sprayer with permethrin or contract a service. And the product that I would be recommending they use is similar to permethrin, bifenthrin. There are all natural solutions out there. There are products that contain botanical things like rosemary oil or cedarwood oil, but the research has shown that those products are pretty much ineffective. They're a waste of money. The perimeter yard sprays, I think, is compatible with bee ecology. We're treating the perimeter, we're treating leaf litter essentially, and you don't see bees foraging in leaf litter. So I think we're keeping the pesticide away from the bees. So I don't think the tick sprays are having really an impact on populations.
Well, what about some of these bees do burrow in the ground, though, right?
Mm-hmm. There could be some collateral damage if for ground nesting bees. But we tell people that, you know, you're putting these things on, you know, twice a year. So they're breaking down within a couple weeks. So from a standpoint of overall population decline, I don't think it's a contributory factor.
Neonicotinoids, I'm not going to be able to pronounce that one.
Neonicotinoids,
oh, may I have it, have long been suspected as one of the culprits in the decline of honeybees. Is there any evidence?
Neonics are highly toxic to bees. One of the problems with the neonics is that they're systemic insecticides, so they translocate through the entire plant, including into the pollen and nectar. So when I'm doing backyard horticulture classes on the Cape, I tell people, if you see product labels that say season-long control or an annual treatment, it's probably a neonic. And I tell people, just don't use those products. There are alternatives that work completely well or effectively. There is a garden center that's taken it on themselves to take those products off shelf. So Hyannis Country Garden, yeah, you go in there, you don't see neonics available.
Mm-hmm. Mace, do you want to add anything to that?
I think that's great advice. It's really hard. As Larry suggested, you know, when we're using insecticides, the products themselves, of course, can be very toxic, and we need to be avoiding exposure. And it's really hard to manage and to not have exposure if you're applying a neonic to a rhododendron or an azalea or something that, you know, you're trying to deal with a pest on it or a bug on it that you don't want to see, but it can be taken into the wood, into the plant material, and come out in that pollen and nectar. and you just add that to that whole pile of causes for bee declines and pollinator declines, monarch butterfly declines, potentially if it's getting into milkweed or other nectar sources for monarchs, and then you can have that exposure problem and be affecting our bees. I think it's great advice.
Even natural pesticides, such as those horticultural oils, they can be harmful to pollinators if they're applied at the wrong time. So what should we keep in mind during the application of those less toxic, I guess I don't even know if you'd call them pesticides, but perhaps they are.
The rule of thumb is you don't spray things that are in bloom.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Avoid things in bloom. Yeah, avoid if you can spray things, spray at night. You know, that also helps if you're putting neem oil or something on. If you're putting diatomaceous earth around plants, just do your best to avoid putting those products on when bees and other pollinators are active. And if you want to get a sense, we actually have an organic pesticide fact sheet just to help people understand that even organic approved pesticides, certainly they're a lot easier on beneficial insects like pollinators, but they do hold risks. And we've got a nice fact sheet on our website just to help you understand which of those are products you need to really be thinking more about compared to others.
Glyphosate is a widely available herbicide, and many have concerns about it locally because it's been identified in our drinking water. Is there any evidence that glyphosate can harm pollinators? Mace, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, there's been recent papers that have come out showing that glyphosate can affect the symbiotic bacteria and fungi and microorganisms that live in the guts of bees. And so, again, it's a situation where if you've got glyphosate getting mixed into pollen and nectar or drinking water for bees that honeybees in particular might collect, that certainly has the potential to be a problem. And I think my biggest concern with glyphosate is just how glibly it is used. You know, it's been touted for years as this safer herbicide. And there are times when we're dealing with invasive species control or plant pests that are really affecting, say, our natural ecosystems or our farms, you know, where it can play an important role in weed control. But I feel like it is incredibly overused. And as a result, it is in the drinking water in Cape Cod. It is in the drinking water in lots of places. And we know that not only for bees, but for people, too, it has, you know, potentially much more of a problem than we thought in the past. And I feel like we need to recognize that these products we can buy off the shelf, like glyphosate, we just need to understand that they do not come with zero risk. And they're not something just to spray willy-nilly around your house or your garden. You need to be very, very thoughtful and really thoughtful about when is a product like that needed. Again, so we can minimize these different risk factors for bees and other pollinators.
And we should be clear, it's not as if you can go into the hardware store and you see a product that's labeled, the brand name isn't glyphosate. So you really do have to read the labels of these. These are basically weed killers, am I right?
They are herbicides. Yeah. So Roundup would be a typical one glyphosate-containing product. And as a rule, when I'm talking to backyard gardeners, I tell people that for your yards and your gardens, you don't have to have perfect manicured properties. At my house, if it's green and grows and it's not poison ivy, it's welcome.
The other thing I just found out yesterday was at a garden club that I was at, the lady goes out with her kettle of boiling hot water and she pours it on the individual weeds that she doesn't want. And she said that works just as well as any weed killer that you could go out there and buy, except I'm sure probably doesn't work for poison ivy. And there was one other thing that bittersweet are the two things that, you know, it doesn't work for. But vinegar is the other thing that you can use, diluted down or straight. But then again, you have to be careful what you're spraying it on, or just it'll kill whatever's around it. And those are natural.
So there are alternatives. We don't need to be. And cheaper. Vinegar is much cheaper, I imagine.
So
is
the
Roundup.
Some hot water, too.
Hot water. We are talking about pollinators this hour. If you have a question or comment, or if you want to talk about some native plants that you have in your yard that are attracting pollinators, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You can also send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince, sitting in for Mindy Todd, and we are talking pollinators this hour with Mace Vaughn, co-director of the Pollinator Conservation and Agricultural Biodiversity Program at the Zesserse Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Larry Dapsis is here. He's an entomologist and tick project coordinator at the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension. And Marty Ayers from the Barnstable County Beekeepers Association. We welcome your calls, questions, or comments. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Monarch butterflies are one pollinator that get a lot of attention because of their beauty and that epic migration. Mace, what is the path of monarch migration in North America?
So the path of the migration is such that they spend the winters, the eastern population, I should say there are two populations. There's a western population of monarchs that overwinters along the California coast and an eastern population that overwinters in the mountains of central Mexico. Starting about a month or two ago, those overwintering butterflies, which is where we track their annual numbers, begin to break out of their diapause and move north. And so that first generation moves out of Mexico into northern Mexico and Texas. They reproduce on milkweed in Texas and in the southern Great Plains. And then over the course of two or three generations, they will make it all the way up to Cape Cod, all the way up to Maine and southern Canada. And then that last generation, three, four, five generations removed from the butterflies that were overwintering in Mexico the year before, they turn around and they fly themselves potentially, you know, a couple thousand miles all the way back to those overwintering sites to repeat that cycle. It's pretty amazing.
So what is the lifespan of a typical, you know, if you have a monarch caterpillar in your yard and it turns into a butterfly, what's the lifespan of that particular butterfly?
Well, it'll take 2 or 3 weeks for an egg to hatch and grow into an adult butterfly. And then during the summer, when they're in that sort of migratory and reproductive life stage, you know, that adult butterfly might live then for another 3 to 6 weeks as it, depending on how much nectar it gets and you know, the problems it encounters as it flies around. So let's say in the order of 3 to 4 weeks more often, like usually. But then that last generation that turns around to fly back to Mexico, I mean, those butterflies are living for 5 months or longer.
Wow. How threatened is the monarch, and how long have we been seeing a decline in the numbers?
Well, we've been seeing a steady decline in the numbers really since we first found those overwintering sites in Mexico. We went from, if we look back 20 or 30 years, there were hundreds of millions of butterflies overwintering in Mexico for this eastern population, and that dropped precipitously over the last 20 years to where we had only a few tens of millions. I will say for the eastern population, this year we saw a little bit of a boost. We had a really good year last year. Early spring weather in Texas was great. The weather across the rest of the eastern U.S. was great. And we saw, you know, we saw over 100 million butterflies overwintering in Mexico. That is very different from what we saw in California, where we're actually worried that for the western population where I live, that we may be at the point of seeing the extinction of that migration in the West. We went from tens of millions of butterflies in the 1980s to 200,000 butterflies last year to 28,000 butterflies this year. And we worry that we've hit a real extinction threshold for that migration on the West Coast. Fingers crossed that that's not true.
Well, Marty was looking very excited when you were talking about the spike in numbers on the East Coast. What, Marty, want to chime in here?
Oh, sure. It was the 300 that we raised last year that made all the difference in the world.
So if you want to attract monarchs or at least provide habitat for them, what are some, Larry, what are some of the plants that we can be including in our yards and what are some of the ones we should be avoiding?
Sure. When people were realizing that the monarchs were in trouble, a number of people thought, okay, we're going to help the monarchs and plant milkweed. Well, a number of people were planting the wrong species of milkweed. Maybe Mace can chime in on this. The native milkweed that we have goes dormant in late summer, and that signals the monarch butterfly to shut down reproduction and get ready to head south. There are some tropical species of milkweed that don't go dormant. So it fools the monarchs into keep laying eggs and having caterpillars, and then you get frost, and the show's over. So if people want to plant milkweed for the monarchs, you got to consult and plant the right species.
And Marty, you were saying that you... Oh, go ahead, Mace.
No. I really agree with what Larry just said. I'll let Marty go.
Oh, I was just going to ask you. You said you raised 300 monarchs. Tell us more about that.
Soar's Nursery over on Sandwich Road. One of the ladies that works there is an avid, you know, save the butterfly person, and she's been doing it for a few years. So she got all of us on board last year, and we all bought our little cages, and they've got a great area around the nursery where they've been laying the eggs. So we would go out and cut the egg portion of the leaf off and start raising them. So we had fun learning. You know, my sister said, oh, we did that when my kids were 12 years old or 10 years old. And I go, well, I never had any kids, so I didn't have to go through that.
And it's, it's not as if you can order the eggs. You really have to go to a place where the butterflies are laying them naturally.
Well, that's my understanding of it anyhow.
Yeah.
And then you go ahead.
Yes, for sure.
Go ahead, Mace.
I was going to say, it is possible to order monarch butterflies, and I strongly discourage people from doing that. One of the challenges with rearing any species is the potential, just like with honeybees or other species, to build up disease. And if you're not careful in how you raise and how you manage butterflies, and if you buy, you know, butterflies from a service, you know, you don't really necessarily know how disease-free they are, and are you potentially spreading disease around? Because disease is one of the concerns for what's affecting monarch butterflies, and something we really need to be paying attention to, yeah, as we're either rearing them or certainly don't buy them. If you're going to have fun rearing them, definitely, as Marty's suggesting, you know, find some eggs and bring in very fresh plant materials and have clean rearing environment to be able to raise them in a way that doesn't add disease to the population.
So if we just, you know, plant outdoors and then just let them do what they do best, and we don't intervene or get in the way otherwise, that's the solution.
Right. But again, we have to have that habitat, right? It seems like around here, if we're and milkweed, I think for many years was considered a really pesty weed. I have a section of my yard that we've left as meadow, and the milkweed is fabulous. And when it's in bloom, it's just a buzz with pollinators, but it also shows up everywhere. I'm forever pulling it out of my vegetable garden or my flower. You know, it can spread very quickly and easily all on its own.
It can. It can be a little bit invasive, but there are other things people can plant. I mean, people, you know, their own landscape, people can do a lot to help all pollinators, and it doesn't require, you know, large, you know, you don't have to sacrifice your entire lawn, things like that.
So what are some of those?
Consider leaving, you know, patches of bare open ground. That is habitat for solitary bees, so you can go a long way. You can leave, you know, tall grassy areas that would allow bumblebees to establish nests in the early spring. So simple things.
And does the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension have a list of different options? So if people are interested in learning more, or they want to improve the habitat in their yard, is there a place they can go?
We would be posting fact sheets that have already been generated by NRCS or Xerce Society. There's a phone app called Bee Smart, BEE, that actually provides you a guide to the types of plants that you would want to put out there to help.
Mm-hmm. Your local extension service also would probably have lists of, you know, native pollinating plants that they'd be able to utilize.
Sure. Mm-hmm. If you would talk to our master horticulturist, Russell Norton, in our department, he would be a good coach for what you could be doing.
Do you want to add anything to that, Mace?
Oh, I mean, it's certainly, as Larry's suggesting too, you know, Xerce has been compiling information like this for 25 years. And we've got one thing that I would add that's maybe a little unique is we've been putting together monarch butterfly nectar plant lists for every region of the country. So that's something else that's on our website. And if you look for nectar plants for monarch butterflies, But I would just add, really, that what's been exciting for me in doing this work for the past 20 years is just how many of those resources are available. And the fact that you, everybody who's listening, can go out into their garden and look to see what plants, as they go for a walk through the neighborhood or they look at their own yard, what plants really seem to be attracting bees and butterflies, and think about adding more of those to the landscape. You know, you could even do your own sort of on-farm, on-home research, too.
So I would just like to add that, I don't know if I'm promoting here or not, but Soar's Nursery has the milkweed seeds that they were handing out to their customers last fall, and they still had some as gifts when they had their open house this spring. So they probably could get the seeds there to plant in their own yards and then come on back, and we'll teach you how to raise the butterflies, too.
And, Marty, the Barnstable Beekeepers Association offers a bee school and a wealth of information for honeybee enthusiasts. Tell us more about the bee school and the other services that are offered through the association.
The school just had all of our graduates. We had about 50 people in the class, which is what we limit it to every year. And we teach people that are interested in beekeeping how to do it properly by having the classes, which are six classes for 2 hours each, spread out over the 3 months. And then they're all assigned a mentor for the first year, so they'll have someone to go back through and lead them through that first year of their beekeeping. What was the rest of the question?
Well, I'm also curious, how much of that is, I mean, if you're going to have bees, I imagine you need to have the habitat to support them as well. So is that part of the course, talking about what to plant, what kinds of environments the bees will thrive in?
Well, first of all, the bees will travel up to 3 to 5 miles to look for their source. And they usually are interested in something more than two or three plants in our favorite pretty little gardens. They'll be attracted to a larger area of one species of plant, because they'll only take the pollen or the nectar from that one species per trip. They don't mix them up. And so when they go back and tell the rest of the girls where to go fly, it's usually a larger area. And they have their own bee talk, the wag dance, that they'll tell them what direction and how far it is. By the vibration of their body on the comb. So if people are interested in planting something, I would say, first of all, to have a larger amount than your normal two or three plants that you would have. And go in successions, of what's during the season, because perennials only last for 3 months, 3 weeks usually in bloom. So my trick is always, we'll go to the nursery and see what perennials are blooming at that time. And if you don't have it in your garden, then, you know, buy that and put it in.
Well, we had talked earlier about not purchasing monarch eggs, but bees are one of the pollinators that you actually do, you buy them, right? And they, as you were saying, you had 300 boxes or hives arriving.
Yeah.
So how do we ensure that those are the health of those bees? Is there any concern about amateur beekeeping maybe causing some of these diseases, or
no? Not to my knowledge, no. It's more the habitat of what they're going into that, you know, is the problem for them. And then, you know, the big thing was we talked about the mites, you know. Which come with the bees. So they're brought up when we bring the packages up from down south. They're already on their bodies. And we also have the small hive beetle, which is another issue that's in the hive. But that's not as detrimental as the varroa mites in the hive.
Mace, the Xerces Society has created a Bee Better certification for farms and products, so folks aren't interested in raising their own bees, they can also help out in this way. Can you tell us more about that certification and if it's gaining traction in the marketplace?
Yeah, it's a brand new certification, and we've got just a couple of farms. Actually, the largest organic almond orchard in California was one of our first farms that was certified, and we've got maybe a dozen or so that are looking at it right now, and conversations with many different industries and farms across the country, including actually in New England. And it's, like I said, it's brand new, and so we're hoping to get our first product out our first certified product out in the next few months. But all of it's so fresh that it's hard to really talk about just yet. Until you see Be Better certified products on your store shelves, you know, I think it's another reason for people to look for organic produce and things like that as a way to support those farmers and others that are, you know, trying to take action that reduces inputs into the environment and is more generally trying to be, you know, more sustainable. But keep your eyes open. Be Better Certified will be out there soon.
And what would your advice be to homeowners, you know, I know that you, your father lives on the Cape, so you're familiar with the environment around here. What would you suggest to Cape and Islands folks about how they can, on their own properties, promote pollinators or at least not harm them?
Yeah, well, I certainly think, as we've been talking about, getting as many flowers out there as possible is really key. If you're worried about invasive milkweed, it's really the common milkweed that's the one that sends out those shoots that spread across your lawn or garden. If you're worried about that, butterfly milkweed or swamp milkweed are two nice species that produce abundant flowers and stay much more contained. There are all sorts of those nectar plants. And I think for me, what's interesting about this is, on the one hand, every day for work, I face, how do we stop the decline of pollinators? How do we help support them? But the solution is so fun, and that's what makes my job pretty exciting. Like, to be able to create a flower garden or a yard full of clover, and to see not just those flowers, but these animals on them, I think is really exciting. So flowers are key. Larry mentioned ground nesting bees and having areas of bare soil, but also just protecting, if you've got rock piles, if you've got a forest edge or a forest understory that is covered with a thick organic matter, leaf litter. That leaf litter is a place where bumblebee queens are going to overwinter, where in fact they may even nest. And so to maintain those areas, to not clean things up too much, and if you're, you know, to have that that meadow in your yard, if you want to do it, I joke that, you know, I'm here to give you an excuse to keep things a little bit messier than you might not want. And if you're concerned about your neighbors, create a crazy, wonderful habitat, mow an edge on it, and stick a pollinator habitat sign on it. And everyone goes, oh, okay, this is a meadow for pollinators. Cool. It's got a nice edge. Everybody's happy.
I saw that sign last night on your website. Is it possible for us to purchase it?
Yes, it is. It is. We've been asking people recently to become members of the Xerces Society. We're a membership-based group. About a quarter to a third of our funding comes from members. And by becoming a member, you're able to get a sign. We also have a Bring Back the Pollinators campaign, where we've got thousands of gardens and farms and folks who've gone on and signed a pledge that you can find at bringbackthepollinators.org. You can sign a pledge, get your habitat or your garden or your farm on a map, and, you know, be able to then also look to see if you can get a sign to stick out there. I actually think the signs are pretty nice, but I'm biased.
I thought it looked nice.
It's a great way to tell your neighbors, here's what I'm doing.
All right. Well, we will post links to the Xerces Society, the Barnstable Beekeepers Association, and the Barnstable County Native Plants and the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension at our website, capeandislands.org. Mace, thank you so much for joining us and getting up early this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Larry Dapsis, thank you. And Marty Ayers, thanks for coming in.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
I'm Amy Vince. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.